Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, Brian Lehrer here. Up next, Brian Lehrer Weekend, three of our favorite segments from the week packaged together for you to listen to on the weekend. So enjoy, and I'll see you back on the radio Monday at 10 a.m. on WNYC and WNYC.org. WNYC, as our phones are open for your eulogies for Toni Morrison and your favorite Toni Morrison quotes. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And Sean in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Thanks so much for calling.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be on. The piece I want to reference is called Racism and Fascism. It's her address to Howard in 1995. It's long, of course, but beautiful. It starts with a 10-part deconstruction of the approach to undermining a group of people. I'll just reference number 8. It is criminalize the enemy, then prepare, budget for, and rationalize the building of holding areas for the enemy, especially its males, and absolutely its children. I won't read too much into that. Mm-hmm. I think we all can, but I encourage everybody to look it up, Racism and Fascism. It's a beautiful address. I think much of what I read of her made me put my hand over my heart, and she often said that we can't be silent, so don't let her be silent, and I encourage everybody to read anything of hers.
Thank you for your call, Sean. Lana in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hello, Lana.
Hi. Thank you so much for taking my call. I chair a group called the Literary Society, and we've been around for 37 years, and we've read much of Toni Morrison. But what I'd like to quote is a eulogy that was written by David Carrasco, who is a professor at Harvard University. And he, one of the things, I want to say something about her first, but she wrote in her Nobel lecture, we die, that may be the meaning of life, but we do language, that may be the measure of our lives. That's directly Toni Morrison. And one of the things that she said to David Carrasco that he quoted in a eulogy to her about her, he says, she once told me, you know, David, the real story is that the people who were treated like beasts did not become beastly. Toni Morrison.
Lana, thank you so much. Avery in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Avery.
Hi, how are you?
Good, how are you?
I've never had it so good.
Not many people are saying that these days.
Well, you know, if you keep saying it, you know, you'll believe it. It'll be something that you put out in the ether, and that's what you'll create.
There you
go.
The
one thing that I would like to share is that I would encourage everyone to go and see the pieces that I am. I just saw it a couple of weeks ago, and it's a documentary on Toni Morrison. And I just believe that when you go and see it, your life will be forever changed. And that is my comment.
Thank you so much. Sally, yeah. in Prospect Heights, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, it's actually Prospect Park South.
Oh, sorry. Hi.
That's okay. So I was actually a student of Toni Morrison's when I was in college. I was lucky enough to have a couple of classes with her. And I actually had her the day that she won the Nobel Prize, which was really incredible. You know, I heard in my class that morning, another class that morning that she had, and I was like, how am I going to go see her this afternoon? And it was incredible. Like, she had an aura unlike anybody that I had ever met in my whole life. Like, her charisma kind of lit up the room, and she had this warmth and sort of twinkly sparkle in her eye that was something I'd never experienced before from anyone, and haven't since. I mean, like, her writing ability was, you know, unmatched and inspiring, and I worked so hard for those classes. You know, I was like, I can't turn in a last minute procrastinated paper for this. So,
did she say anything about the Nobel to the class that day?
Sure. I mean, what she was sort of she was calm and excited, but also, like, you could see how proud she was, you know. And, you know, she'd given us this vast writing assignment for that week, and I'd been, like, staying up late, and then we ended up talking a lot about the experience in the class and not covering all the things we'd read. But she was talking about, you know, she was sort of talking about just, like, the call she got in the morning and the press, and there were reporters, like, everywhere in the hallway. But, you know, she carried on with class, and, you know, I think it was just sort of sinking in at that point. Mm-hmm. But I do remember when we were, I think, maybe breaking for Thanksgiving, and, you know, I wished her a good break, and she said, oh, I have a little speech I have to write, so it might not be that relaxing.
Well, we're going to play a clip from that little speech. Sally, thank you so much for
thank you, Brian.
For recalling that day. And we did pull about a minute excerpt from Toni Morrison's Nobel acceptance speech. This was, again, for the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1993. And here's about a minute of what she had to say in that speech about some uses of language.
The systematic looting of language can be recognized by the tendency of its users to forego its nuanced, complex, midwifery properties for menace and subjugation. Oppressive language does more than represent violence. It is violence. Does more than represent the limits of knowledge. It limits knowledge. Whether it is obscuring state language or the faux language of mindless media, whether it is the proud but calcified language of the academy or the commodity-driven language of science, whether it is the malign language of law without ethics or language designed for the estrangement of minorities, hiding its racist plunder in its literary cheek, it must be rejected, altered, and exposed.
Toni Morrison, from her Nobel Prize for Literature speech in 1993. As we continue to welcome your eulogies and favorite Toni Morrison quotes. Jeffrey in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jeffrey.
Hey, Brian, I get really nervous with this stuff, so I apologize. I get nervous when I'm on the air. I was 22 when I first read Beloved. I got a copy the day it came out, and I was a young, obviously, gay, new college graduate, English teacher. And I was living in San Francisco because I'd gone out there to escape my parents, and, you know, I'd been through a lot, and I read Beloved, and I got to the end when Paul D passed Denver sitting on the stairs, and he asked her how things were coming along, and she said, and I think most of us know the plot of Beloved, she said, don't pay to complain. And I feel like Toni Morrison, that was not her motto. Her motto was to take horrors, both past and current, and turn them into something beautiful, relatable, uplifting, And I've been crying for days. I haven't cried this much since Vito Russo died at the loss of an icon. And the last thing I want to say is that she pretty much ruined every book that I read after that for about 20 years.
Thank you, Jeffrey. I'm going to leave it there. Thank you so much.
Sure, man.
You had no problem being on the air. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Leslie in Florham Park. You're on WNYC. Hi, Leslie.
Hi, Brian. How are you?
Okay, thank you. What you got?
Well, I just wanted to say that I really think when I'm thinking about Toni Morrison and all that she contributed, I really think that she exemplified Black girl magic before we had Black girls rock and before we actually had a term for what Black girl magic was. She was brave, she was vulnerable, she was strong, and she was unapologetic. When I think about the current climate we're in today, I'm reminded of her quote that the function, the very serious function of racism is distraction. And that kind of keeps me grounded when I hear certain things, either from the office of the presidency or from Facebook feeds, Twitter feeds, that I don't need to be distracted. I don't need to dive so deeply into other people's ignorance that I am forced to either make myself whole or human in their eyes, or that I stop doing the work of freedom work.
Thank you so much. Well said. Luna in West Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Luna.
Hi. Well, first of all, when I read that she had died, I actually yelled, oh, my God, oh, my God, oh, my God. And I had to call a friend of mine because the grief was too much. I've read almost every book that she has written. And on my on the wall of my desk, I have three writers who are my favorite writers, and I read a lot. And one is Gabriel Garcia Marquez, one is Isaac Bashevis Singer, and Toni Morrison. And I also thought, somebody said that she thought Toni Morrison would live forever. And I had the same feeling. And I wanted to say that whenever I read one of her books, I didn't know how tightly she had held me until the last word of the book, when it was like, okay, my breath, I didn't even realize, I can let my breath go. Mm. And she has a quote from Song of Solomon that I love. And I want to say before I say that the word ride is R-I-D-E because your screener called me to make sure. And what she says is, if you surrender to the air, you could ride it. And to me, that's about let go. Let go.
Thank you, Luna. Thank you so much. George in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, George.
My earliest recollection of Toni Morrison was when she was interviewed in 1998 by that Australian reporter, Jane Wendt. And the reporter asked her, and this was right after she won the Nobel Prize, shortly thereafter, why she didn't incorporate white lives into her books. And Toni Morrison really went back in a very profound way, saying, and I'm just paraphrasing in her quote, to the Australian reporter, she said, "You can't understand how powerfully racist that question is, can you?" She said to the reporter. And she said, Toni Morrison said, "You could never ask a white author, why are you going to write about black people?" And that, I found that such a very sharp response. And when President Obama said inclusive as one of the adjectives he used in that speech you played earlier, mm-hmm. I think her entire writing, from The Blue West Eyes all the way up, you know, Son of Solomon, et cetera, were primarily focused on the African-American experience. And that's all I have to say.
George, thank you so much. And so as a segue from that, we will conclude this segment with 39 seconds of Toni Morrison in her own words. This is from a New York Times interview some years ago, and they produced this excerpt with a music bed in which she talks about, or in this clip, she talks about developing her first novel, The Bluest Eye.
At the very beginning, when I wrote the first book, The Bluest Eye, I came at it as not a writer, but a reader. And such a story didn't exist. Every little homely black girl was a joke or didn't exist in literature. And I was eager to read about a story where racism really hurts and can destroy you. And it's not a joke, as they made out that we were.
Toni Morrison. And thanks for your eulogies and favorite quotes. It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. New York State's Child Victims Act goes into effect next week. It opens a one-year window for anyone to sue over past allegations of child sexual abuse, regardless of when it occurred. Maybe you've been seeing or hearing new law firm commercials recruiting clients for this. There was one I saw last night that we grabbed off the web today. Let's take a listen just as an example.
If you are a survivor of child sexual abuse in New York, now is the time to come forward. The New York legislature has changed the law, allowing survivors of child sexual abuse to come forward and take legal action. We understand, based on decades of experience, why it takes a survivor so long to come forward. If you do come forward, you can make a difference in your own life and in the lives of others. Take action today, and you can help protect New York's children.
Now, that, of course, is just one example, so you hear what's going on. We're not endorsing any particular law firm. In fact, I think we cut the idea of the law firm out of that version of it, from what I heard. There are many law firms trying to get into this space. But with that as a starting point, WNYC's Mara Silvers joins us now. She's reporting on the opening of the Child Victims Act look back window. Hi, Mar.
Hi, Brian.
So again, the term is look back window. Can you explain what that is?
Right. So essentially what the look back window is supposed to do is open up an opportunity for anybody who's been barred from filing these claims, these civil claims in the past. Because as a lot of people might know, New York's law used to require anyone who was abused as a child to file a civil claim before their 21st birthday. They could also file a criminal complaint before their 23rd birthday. But then after that, they were essentially cut out of the criminal legal system for the purposes of suing either their alleged abuser or the institution that they wanted to hold accountable. So this look back window is really intended to say anybody who has a civil claim can come forward now, and for 1 year, those claims can be reintroduced or introduced for the first time in court.
So listeners, who wants to help us report this story? Are there any lawyers listening right now who may be preparing to take these cases with the look back window? What do you think clients would have to demonstrate to prove in either the criminal or civil lawsuit spaces that they were sexually abused as children many years ago, or listeners who were sexually abused as children yourselves and have never come forward in any way, either in the legal system or maybe even personally to other people, are you now grappling with whether to take advantage of this Child Victims Act look back window and whether this will be good for you in the long run or whether this will just be more pain? Are you grappling with this? Call us up. Are you a lawyer? Call us up, or anyone else relevant or with a question. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And Mara, is this both for criminal and civil law?
No. So the look back window is only for civil cases. Actually, California in 2003 opened up a look back window as well, and they tried to include criminal cases in that. It was actually deemed unconstitutional to try to prosecute a criminal complaint that previously was not able to be prosecuted. So only civil claims in this window. And that said, the New York Child Victims Act overall does expand the statute of limitations for criminal complaints by a few years. So like I said beforehand, you had to make that decision about criminal cases before you were 23. Now the law says that you have until 28 to do that. So it's a slight increase for criminal cases, but it is an increase. And for civil cases, the law going forward is going to give victims until their 55th birthday to bring civil cases. But the look-back window is kind of distinct from that. So there's two parts of the law. Yeah.
So the look-back window is for anyone of any age for this limited period of time.
Correct, for civil cases.
For civil cases. You can sue people, in other words. And what is it again, 1 year?
1 year.
Mm-hmm. Do we have any indication of how large this wave of lawsuits will be?
That is a really good question. So based off of the attorneys that I've talked to, they're all saying that they're representing 200 alleged victims, 400 victims, 500 victims. So we can say hundreds is pretty pretty likely. It's potentially going to be even more than that, into the thousands. And the reason why I say that is based off of other states that have opened up look-back windows. They have seen pretty high numbers. So Minnesota, for example, saw about 1,000 cases, between 900 and 1,000 cases filed during its look-back window. And New York, as a state, has about 35 times the population of Minnesota. Yeah. So you can kind of look just side by side and expect that there might be well into the thousands in this state.
It's staggering. And it's, you know, kind of depressing also to realize as this opens up and more people come forward that the extent of people, I think mostly from institutions like schools and the Boy Scouts and churches and synagogues and stuff, taking advantage of their positions to molest children, maybe even more than we thought.
I think that's a really good point. It's heavy. It's very serious. It can be a lot for people to wrap their heads around. But the people who I've talked to who are more familiar with this field say this is more common than we would ever like to admit, and also really common for not just in public and private institutions, but also in more more private circumstances. So within families and friends and close kin, anybody really can be a victim of this. It's not isolated to one group or another.
Let's take a phone call. Roy in Brooklyn. Roy, you're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling in.
Yeah, he said he paid $140 for them, but whatever.
Roy, you're talking to me or are you talking to someone else? I think Roy's at work. All right. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. With so many victims, have people given any consideration to filing a class action suit? Or would that be counterproductive because then there wouldn't be as much money to be recovered for individuals from individual perpetrators?
So that's a really interesting question, and it's one that I asked as well. But there's actually not really class actions in these cases. So these are mass tort cases, but they're not class actions because class actions, as I understand them, and again, if we have a lawyer on the phone, feel free to speak to this, but class actions are for people who are similarly affected by something that a defendant did or didn't do. So other situations of...
So a faulty toy that injured a lot of kids, but it all came from the same manufacturer.
Exactly. But in child sex abuse cases, the court identifies all people as individuals because they are impacted differently. And so their experiences are unique. And in that way, a class action wouldn't really be applicable. However, there are other ways for many victims who have similar experiences to come together, and that often shows up in bankruptcy proceedings, which we can get to a little bit later. But for the purposes of class action or not, not really in these situations.
Brian in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Brian.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. What you got?
So I wanted to just correct a few minor mistakes.
Okay.
Or characterizations. The Child Victims Act was signed into law by Governor Cuomo on February 14th, and that extended the statute of limitations for childhood sexual abuse to age 55. It had previously been 23 for civil and 21 for criminal.
And I think that's what Mark said, but go ahead.
The window is what goes into effect on next Wednesday.
Yes, I think that's what we've been describing, but did you also tell our screener that you are a survivor who intends to sue?
I am, yes. I will be filing a suit through my lawyer on the 14th. And the reason, I don't know if that's what you,
it's up to you.
Want to know, but the reason is because this has been such a shame-filled secret for so many people. And whenever a survivor comes forward, another survivor gets the courage to come forward. And each survivor that comes forward, there's the potential of exposing another predator that has been able to wait out the clock and hide behind this previously very inadequate statute of limitation.
It's a wonderful way to put it. So when you come forward, you're not only coming forward for yourself, is the way you're looking at it.
It's. I've noticed I worked for 3 years to get the bill passed, and what I have learned is it's exponential. Someone comes forward, maybe two more people then come forward, and they inspire some other people. And you get your life back. Whether you're suing or getting any kind of financial reward or anything, just the fact that this isn't looming over your head as a secret at the bottom of your soul, let's say, you do get your life back, and it's a remarkable thing, and I want as many people to be able to get that as possible.
Thank you so much for contributing that to this conversation. Mara, did you want to add to that?
Yeah, that's something that I've heard from a lot of people who I've talked to who are planning on filing cases. They say that the only reason why they talked to me for my reporting was because of the hope that somebody else would hear their story and feel a little less alone. And so that's a common sentiment, and I think an important one because of, like the caller mentioned, the secrecy and the shame often surrounding this. One of the people in my stories spoke to me but still wanted to be anonymous. We called him John Doe in our reporting because he was still concerned about what people would think of him if they knew this about his life.
Let's try Roy in Brooklyn again. Roy, you're on WNYC. Hi, you there?
Hello?
Hi, Roy. You're on the air.
Hi, Brian. Brian, I'm wondering, I'm hearing about these lawsuits about child molestation. Are these pertaining to just organizations, or is it opened up to, for instance, I've been molested since I was young by a family member, and it really, you know, destroyed my life. You know, I wonder if I have any recourse against something like that. I mean, I know he's a wealthy gentleman.
Roy, thank you for your courage in calling up to ask that question and make that revelation, which is so, so painful.
Right. Yeah. Thank you, Roy. The answer is it's not just limited to institutions. It's also open to individuals. So again, these are civil claims that can be filed starting next week for 1 year against an alleged perpetrator, but also against an institution that allegedly allowed this abuse to occur under their watch.
Marita in Midwood, you're on WNYC. Hi, Marita.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I believe that the person who tried to molest me is dead, long dead, and I'm not interested in money. I'm interested in having his name publicized. And he wasn't part of an institution. Is it possible to do that?
Through a lawsuit, you mean, in the look-back window?
Yes.
That's a really interesting question. I would say I'm not sure about that. I think that some of the benefits of filing a lawsuit that a lot of attorneys and and alleged victims have said is that they want their story to be public. They want names to be public. But I think that it's a little it's complicated if an individual is not part of an institution like the Catholic Church that releases lists of credibly accused priests, for example. So the short answer is I'm not sure.
Yeah, and I think for both of our last two callers, Marita and Roy, you should probably contact attorneys. You're not going to have to pay them anything, I would imagine, in these cases, because these kinds of suits, I think, are done on a commission basis. So you certainly should be able to get a consultation, a first-time consultation with a lawyer for free in just about any case. And you could ask each of these questions, like in Roy's case, how does he go about suing an individual who molested him as a child, who he says ruined his life? In Marita's case, how does she go about if the law allows suing maybe the estate of a person who she believes is deceased, or bringing some other kind of action that puts the name of her perpetrator into the legal system or into the public space in some way? So those are good questions. How many of these suits, or what percentage of these suits, if there are early indications, Mara, would be against institutions?
That's hard to say just based on the number, the breakdown. But I think from my reporting, there have been a lot of situations where the alleged abuser has passed away, but the institution remains. And that is a focal point for a lot of people looking to bring these cases. So I'm not sure. Some of these cases are from decades ago, the 1950s, the 1960s. So then an individual might not be around in those cases.
And in fact, there are at least three players in many of these legal fights: the victims, the organizations, and then there are the insurance companies. And here's a clip of a lawyer talking about the legal strategy of the victims in this respect.
They've alleged negligent supervision. They've alleged breach of fiduciary duty. They've alleged negligent infliction of emotional distress. They've alleged negligent training, obviously with the purpose of trying to trigger insurance policies to cover the claims. Plaintiffs' bar understand that a lot of these institutions won't have assets out of their own pocket to pay these claims, so they want to go where they hope they can find a deep pocket, and that's from the insurance industry.
So that's an attorney at the firm of Hurwitz and Fine, I think, or you did that interview. So.
Yeah, that was Dan Cohane. He spoke to me on the phone the other day.
And that's, well, where does that come in as far as the victims are concerned? Should they care that there's an insurance company behind the Boy Scouts or the church or the particular school or anything like that?
Mm-hmm. So based on the attorneys who I've talked to, factoring in the insurance company is an important part of this for victims, because it's about how big of a settlement you might potentially be able to get. An institution by itself, as Dan mentioned, might not be able to pay out all of the settlements that are coming its way. But if it had an insurer who provided coverage at the time of the alleged abuse, that settlement could potentially be much bigger. But there are so many factors involved in that. And I am not an insurance lawyer, but I've become very interested in insurance law over the course of reporting the story because of the potential litigation that's going to unfold between a lot of these major organizations. For example, the New York Archdiocese in July proactively sued more than two dozen of its insurers to make sure that they come to the table and they help provide coverage when these claims come up.
As we talk about the opening of the look back window for 1 year beginning next week, for anybody who was a victim, allegedly, of child sexual abuse any time in the past, to sue your perpetrators, with WNYC's Mara Silvers, who's reporting on this. This is under the law passed in New York State earlier this year, so this is for New York State. A group of lawyers told NBC News that the Boy Scouts of America were engaged in a cover-up of, quote, a pedophilia epidemic within their organization, unquote. They claim to have identified 350 scoutmasters and volunteers with a history of allegations, So that's a new thing that's coming out now. We will see if that has New York ramifications. And there's Rockefeller University Hospital. Interesting story. A big group of child sex abuse allegations, I think pertaining to one particular doctor who's now deceased. But there's an issue of potential bankruptcy that organizations might declare to shield themselves from some of these suits, right?
Right. So bankruptcy is a tool that a lot of organizations have turned to and started to use because of these the high volume of cases that they're looking at. So bankruptcy, to be clear, there's a couple different types. This is not a situation under Chapter 7 bankruptcy where an institution is liquidated and all of its assets are distributed. This is Chapter 11 bankruptcy. So here there's the potential to pay off all of the creditors under court supervision, basically to come up with a plan to pay off creditors, and then to restructure assets and survive and carry on and start with a clean slate. So that is something that different dioceses in various states have used when faced with a lot of these claims, and it's something that the Boy Scouts has said that it's considering. Rockefeller University Hospital, to my knowledge, has not said whether or not they're considering bankruptcy,
mm-hmm.
But it is something that I'm sure a lot of institutions are thinking about.
Here's an attorney calling in, James in Westchester. James, you're on WNYC. Thanks for chiming in.
Hey, Brian. Thanks for your coverage, and thanks for the very accurate reporting. It's a complicated issue. My law firm represents about 500 victims, 200 in the Rockefeller University case, which just filed a case against its insurers today. So this coverage is very timely and important. And I just wanted to talk very briefly about the class action because we get a lot of questions about this. And I think your reporting is right on target. While it seems like a class action would be, you know, something that would be valid because you have, you know, the Archdiocese, you have Rockefeller University, you have all of these victims, what really separates it apart from, say, your iPhone or some other, you know, the things that we read about in the newspaper is that all of the damages are individualized. So even though you may have one perpetrator, you know, committing these crimes against a wide number of children, each one of them has a different experience, has different damages, and has different outcomes. So that's why a class action really doesn't work. It's sort of like a round, you know, peg in a square hole.
Thanks for explaining that, James. What's the standard of proof that you would have to bring, since it sounds like you have hundreds of clients who are about to do this? How do you prove something that happened maybe decades ago?
That's going to be the real interesting thing about these cases because, you know, we don't know, obviously, as the plaintiff's lawyers, we don't know what are in the files, you know, of the Catholic Church, of Rockefeller University. We don't know what, you know, how long school districts, you know, maintain their records over decades. We need to show as lawyers for plaintiffs that the institution knew or should have known of the individual's propensity to commit these crimes. So it's not a criminal standard. It's not, you know, beyond a reasonable doubt. It's only by a preponderance of evidence. But again, you know, a lot of times these institutions think this is going to be a free-for-all and, you know, you just show up and you win your case or you get a check. And that's not true. There's still some very significant barriers to justice for a lot of victims, and there's still the burden on the plaintiffs to go forward with that case. So that'll be a very interesting to see, you know, how that actually takes effect.
As a layperson, you know, who's not a lawyer, my guess would be that so many, maybe a majority of these cases of child sexual abuse would have taken place without the institution ever actually having found out about it, and therefore there being no paper trail of any kind, and so they'll be impossible to prove. Is that too pessimistic?
That's probably a little too pessimistic. At least we know with the Catholic Church that, you know, through you know, records over decades that they've been aware of this problem, that they've moved pedophile priests around to different parishes. There was a criminal indictment against Dr. Archibald at Rockefeller University in 1960. He was practicing for 30 years after that. So yeah, I think you're being a little bit pessimistic. I mean, I don't know what's more pessimistic, realizing that it happens or hoping that you can't prove it. But
yeah, right.
The reality is I think a lot of these institutions do have knowledge. And if they didn't have actual knowledge, then they certainly had a lot of signs and indications that they should have known. They were not following proper protocols. Doctors were allowed to be in the room with naked children without a chaperone. Doors were shut. Priests were moved around when they received complaints. So, unfortunately, I think what we're going to find out is that a lot of these institutions did have actual knowledge, and for those that didn't, there was an awful lot of clear signs that something was going on.
Mari, you wanted to add to this?
Right. So I just wanted to point out that, yes, exactly. Reginald Archibald was investigated in 1960 in a grand jury investigation. He was never charged with any crime. However, I think it's worth noting that in a report that was done by Rockefeller University's hospital's own lawyers, it pointed out that there were other notifications to the hospital over the course of several years to the head doctor in charge during one time, and then other complaints that were made in the 1990s and the early 2000s. So there were several notices in that specific situation, even though that doctor remained at the hospital for a long time.
James, can you hang on as a lawyer for a second, or just stay for a second and answer a legal question from another caller?
Really can't provide legal advice on the air, but I could do some hypotheticals and give you a broad overview of what the options are.
That's fair enough. So let's put line 9, Terry in the East Village, on and keep James up on his line as well. Terry, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. And my question is, I went to a Catholic girls' school and I was taught by nuns. And one nun in particular kept on beating us on our hands if, we did something that she didn't like. And on the palms of our hands until it really hurt badly. And I was wondering whether, the sadism involved in this borders on sexual
abuse.
Molestation.
Good question. So what makes something... So is there a clear line between what's sexual and what's not sexual abuse, James? And I guess the other implication there is, what if there was physical abuse that wasn't sexual? Is that covered by this look back window?
That's a great question. And what we have as part of the law, as part of the CVA, is you have these predicate criminal acts as defined under New York state law. So the window and the law itself really is looking to the criminal law to see if one of those laws was violated that forms them the basis of the civil case. So every individual case is going to be different, and a lot of times it's very hard to sort of parse those laws. What is misdemeanor? What is sexual abuse of a child? What is attempted? What is, so it's I'm not saying it's a moving target, but it's really going to require an attorney to sit down, look at those predicates, find out if the facts could fit what the criminal law is and what the criminal law may have been at that time, and see if a valid case can be made out. The CVA covers everything from misdemeanors, child endangerment, that kind of thing. A lot of these crimes get pled down to something that's sounds pretty innocuous. But in those cases, clearly physical abuse is not covered. But in those cases where there may have been a sexual motivation, there may have been a sexual component, we'd have to sit down, we'd have to look at the criminal predicate and see if this fact pattern fits into a valid cause of action.
Thank you so much for your help with that. We really appreciate your call and help us explain what's going on with this look back window that opens next week. WNYC's Mara Silvers has been reporting this story. Before you go, this is a particular New York state law, but my understanding is that New Jersey is also doing something like this. Do you know that piece of it?
I'm not very familiar with New Jersey's law, but I do know that they passed a similar law. I'm not sure what the look back window portion of that is, if any, but it was a law affecting their statute of limitations for child sex abuse cases.
And so, listeners, we will get and pass along the New Jersey particulars. But if you want to hear Mara Silver's story, it's at WNYC.org. And thank you so much for coming on and sharing your reporting with us.
Thank you.
We'll be right back. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And there's a new film getting a lot of attention, not just because Queen's own Awkwafina stars in her first dramatic role. It is just opening wide, as they say. And that brings us a chance to talk about The Farewell with its writer and director, Lulu Wang. Lulu, welcome back to WNYC. Congratulations on the film.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
And the film begins with the words, not a spoiler if it's the first thing on the screen, right?
Right.
Based on an actual lie. Can you tell us about this lie?
Yes. My family, when they found out that my grandmother was diagnosed with terminal cancer, decided not to tell her, because in China, they usually tell the family rather than the patient. And in my family's case, they thought it would be best if my grandmother didn't know about it. And instead, as a way to go see her, they created a ruse in the form of a wedding for my cousin. And they used that wedding as an excuse for everyone to go say goodbye to my grandmother without her knowing.
We have a clip where a doctor and the character based on you, Billy, are discussing her grandmother's, her Nai-Nai's condition right in front of her, though she doesn't know English, so it goes right over her head. And Billy, played by Awkwafina, speaks first.
How bad is she? You can tell me the truth.
The cancer is quite advanced.
Shouldn't we tell her?
In her situation, most families in China would choose not to tell her. When my grandmother had cancer, my family didn't tell her.
Isn't it wrong to lie?
I mean, if it's for good, it's not really a lie.
I mean, it's still a lie.
It's a good lie.
It's a good lie. I think a lot of people in this country do the same thing. You know, try to withhold the worst from the person who's the actual patient. And yet I think part of the premise here is that it's a more common sentiment in China.
Mm-hmm, yes. I think there's, you know, the way it was explained to me is that it's the fear that kills people, you know, so often, rather than the disease itself. And my great aunt told me this ancient story in the East of a sick person and a healthy person go to the hospital, and the results get mixed up. So the healthy person gets the sick person's diagnosis, and the sick person gets the healthy diagnosis, and it's the healthy person that ends up dying. And so, you know, there's this belief that that the news, the mind and body are so connected.
And so how bad does a diagnosis need to be for the common practice to be to withhold it from the patient? Does it need to be terminal?
I think it's really up to each individual family. It's not like there's a sort of rule book for this. But I think the main thought process is that the person, what is their personality? Are they going to handle the news well? If there's somebody that's going to get really depressed at hearing this news, they're going to stop eating, they're going to stop sleeping, and sleep deprivation, not eating, not leaving the house, that creates depression. And then it's just a spiral downward.
So listeners, have you ever been in a similar situation? Are you part of a Chinese family or any other family and decided to lie to a family member with a terminal illness about the extent of their condition? Is this a situation you faced in your own family? How did you deal with it? How did you feel about this lie if you were a party to it? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692 on this issue raised in the movie The Farewell. Lulu, do you want to answer first maybe about how you felt about it? Were you ambivalent?
Oh, I was absolutely opposed to it. You know, as an American, I felt that truth is the greatest value and freedom and independence. I felt that we were not respecting my grandmother by withholding the truth about her own health and her own life from her. So that's kind of what the film is about, is this granddaughter going back, being very opposed to this, and yet she would have to go against the entire family in order to reveal the truth. And that's also against her values, to, you know, kind of betray her family in a way. And to respect her family is also important. So she's torn between these two very difficult decisions.
You said just now, as an American, you felt that the transparency should have been the overriding value, is to what degree is this sort of American values versus Chinese values?
Yes, absolutely. Maybe Eastern versus Western. Maybe, you know, new generation, new world versus old world. Because I had a lot of people email me after I did the story for This American Life. They said, you know, my family's from South America and we did the same thing, or we're from the Middle East and we did the same thing. And so it's a lot more commonplace than I originally thought.
What are you depriving the patient of by protecting her from the emotional pain?
I think you're depriving her of her own agency to decide how she wants to spend those last weeks or months of her life. If she has things that she wants to take care of, and she has things that she might want to say before it's too late. And when I asked my family members that, they just said, oh, she doesn't have anything like that. And it was this very, like, making this very easy assumption to know her. And it, you know, really turned me off, because I thought, well, you don't know. But now I think maybe they do know, because it's such a collective society. In many ways, you know, family members, they know each other really, really well. And they sometimes know people better than they know themselves.
Do you think it worked? That is, lying to your grandmother about her condition with the goals of the lie?
Well, my family certainly thinks so, right? They, you know, she outlived her prognosis so far by many, many years.
She did.
You know, if you ask them, they'll say, see, the lie worked. But if you ask my uncle, who was giving her very expensive probiotics that he bought off the internet, he'll say it was those probiotics. And maybe if you ask my parents' friends who are Christian and pray, they'll say it was the power of their prayers. And so in some ways, you know, we'll never really know what it was, but everybody will lean towards the narrative that best supports their belief system.
Let's take a phone call. Russell in the Bronx. You're on WNYC. Hi, Russell.
Hello. Listen, I agree with what the young lady says. I'm a practicing Buddhist, and we have a temple here in the Bronx, and the monks always teach us, you must tell the truth, even if it's brutal. And I think she was very brave, but I think her behavior was proper, but one must never challenge the family.
Wow.
Russell, thank you very much.
Yeah, I mean,
why'd you say wow?
Well, because, you know, he doesn't have an answer either. You have to tell the truth, but you mustn't challenge the family. I mean, those are two contradicting.
There's the tension.
You know, yeah, that's the tension. But interesting to hear from somebody who studies Buddhism, because I think the greater value in Buddhism, yes, truth, but also there's a great amount of value placed on balance and trying to avoid conflict.
Angela in Detroit. You're on WNYC. Hi, Angela.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for taking my call. When I was a little girl, so I'm first generation. My parents are from Italy.
Mm-hmm.
My cousin, who was about 20 years old or so, died in a car accident. And I was about 6 years old. My family, my parents and the rest of the family, decided not to tell my grandmother, who herself was ill, and they felt she could not handle it. And it was heartbreaking because she kept asking, where is Anthony and how come he doesn't visit me anymore? And she died not ever knowing what happened to her grandson.
How do you feel about it today?
Horrible, and always did growing up, and always wanted to say something. I felt it was wrong, but, you know, the family, I was a little girl when it happened, and then when I got older, I just couldn't cross that, you know, that boundary. Mm-hmm.
I have a question, Angela. Do you think that if you were older, let's say you were in your 20s or maybe even early 30s, and it happened while you were an adult, do you think that you would be able to go against the family all on your own and just go tell her?
I very much think I might be. I can't say for certain 100% because the pressure in that situation is so great, but I tend to break rules like that, so I think I would have
you know, or at least I would have campaigned for it. I would have been very vocal about it with the family members.
Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
And for sharing something difficult. Did making this film change your perspective on lying to your grandmother in any way?
A little bit, you know, because in many ways the lie, you know, not that I made this, I not that I intentionally set out to lie to her so that to make a movie, but the lie is what allowed me to make this film. But more importantly, it allowed me to spend more time with my grandmother, because making this film meant I had to go back to scout and to shoot in her city. And, you know, and she was around while that happened. So it was the most amount of time I've ever spent there since I was a very little girl. And she also came to set and was able to see her granddaughter doing what she loved to do. And I don't think that she ever imagined in her lifetime that she would get to see me direct an American film with an American crew.
We have so many calls coming in from people with all kinds of backgrounds, from Colombia, from Nigeria, all kinds of things. So we'll take some more phone calls when we continue. We'll also play two more clips from the film, The Farewell, as writer and director Lula Wang is with us. Stay tuned. Brian Lehrer on WNYC as we continue with Lulu Wang, writer and director of the film The Farewell, which is opening wide, as they say, in theaters as of today, right?
Yes.
So it's around, is it in multiple theaters in New York?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay, so there you know, folks. And some of you also know that before this was a movie, it was a story on This American Life about withholding the information from her grandmother about her grandmother's terminal illness and the sort of the tension between transparency and protecting someone emotionally. Here's another clip from the film. In this one, it's a scene where the character based on you, named Billy, breaks down crying, talking with her mother about moving to America as a kid. Billy speaks first.
You know, one of the few good memories of my childhood were those summers at Nai Nai's. They had that garden. Yeah, and I would catch dragonflies. And then we just moved to the States. Everything was different. Everyone was gone. It was just the three of us.
I know it was hard. It was hard for us too.
I wanted to believe that it was a good thing. But all I saw was fear in your eyes. And I was confused and scared constantly because you never told me what was going on.
Was that scene based on reality?
Yeah, you know, it still gets me every time, that scene, because I never had that conversation in real life with my mother. But as I was writing the screenplay, I had to do a lot of digging emotionally to figure out what this was about for me, beyond just losing my grandmother. What did that symbolize? And I came to, you know, to these words. And in a way, Billy in the movie says the words that I never have said in real life to my mother.
Chris in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Ryan. Good afternoon, sir. How are you doing today?
Good. How are you doing?
Sorry, good morning. Great. Yeah. I just want to add a little bit contribution to what you guys are talking about. I'm from Nigeria originally.
Mm-hmm.
So my experience is that, you know, I know it's bad to lie sometimes, but sometimes, you know, withholding information to save another situation is important, because I was talking about my wife. So my wife, before we had my first daughter 6 years ago,
mm-hmm.
I know who she is. She really can't take some news, you know, because she has a very soft heart. So her brother was involved in an accident, which about 15 people died in the accident, you know. It was like a head-on collision, you know.
Oh, my.
So, and she has had like two previous miscarriages. So, and she was pregnant with my daughter. She was like 4-5 months pregnant. And I knew if I let her know that her brother was involved in an accident, I don't know how she was going to take it. And that might lead to another miscarriage, you know.
Mm.
So I was going to make sure that, you know, that never happens again. So I, when the call came in, I called everybody and said, like, don't tell my wife that the brother had an accident because she's not going to take it, you know. Mostly, not that she can't even talk to him. She's going to think the brother is dead. So,
when did you finally tell her?
So it took like 4 months for me to tell her when she was almost trying to put to bed, you know. But that was hard. That was difficult for me. For those 4 months was one of the most difficult periods. Seeing her every day, you know, it was tough, you know. And the last one was when my grandfather passed. I also couldn't tell my mom, you know. We have to make sure we deceive her to my grandfather's house so that she can be told in the presence of all the family members. So when she will start the drama of crying and all these things, there will be enough people, you know, to hold her down, you know?
To wait until then. Chris, thank you so much for sharing those stories. I'm sure that was not easy. And I guess his story kind of reminds us it's not just about the particular situation, you know, of somebody has a terminal illness diagnosis, but there are various situations of potentially traumatic news that people might withhold from loved ones.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And sometimes, you know, like we explore in the movie, your desire to tell somebody the truth is just to take that burden off of your own hands. And so, you know, like this gentleman just said, that it was very difficult for him to carry that burden for his wife and lie to her for all those months. But he did it as a way to protect her.
Tom in Garden City, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tom.
Hi there. Thank you. Yes, my wife is from China. her family is back there. We go there a couple of times a year. And this situation has happened with her mother twice in the past 10 years. 10 years ago, my wife's younger brother died suddenly at work. And the older brother who takes care of the mother at home decided not to tell her. He said it would be too much for her. She's very frail, has had poor health for a number of years, and he just said it's too much. And so they lied to her, and they told her that he got in some trouble at work. You know, he had a very fairly powerful job dealing with both the government and construction industry, and they just said that he had some trouble and he had to leave the country. And he went to Australia. And she asked about him all the time, and over the years, her inquiries have gotten fewer and fewer, and she doesn't even ask about him. And this is her son, the youngest of her three children. He had a widow and a young daughter at the time. And
so this isn't just a decision to delay telling her. This is a decision to never tell her.
They never told her, and I was opposed to it, of course. But I'm I'm the foreigner who can't understand, right? The way things are handled in China. I've been going there over 30 years. I know the culture very well, and I kind of understand where they're coming from. But I thought she should have had an opportunity to properly mourn her son.
What are you thinking as you hear this story, Lulu?
Well, it's a very common story. I have several friends with very, very similar examples, and I, you know, also feel like it's very wrong. And who are we to make that decision? But you said that her inquiries got fewer and fewer as time went on. Do you think on some level that she knew and that she herself was keeping the secret of the fact that she, deep down, she knew?
I think so. They buried his ashes in the same, a year or so before this happened, her husband died, my father-in-law, and they buried his ashes in the same crypt, and they just stopped taking her there. She wanted to mourn her husband, and they'd say, no, you're too frail, stay at home. And they, you know, she has a little shrine at home, as some people do, and just do it there at home. It's too much for you to go up in the mountain where the crypt is.
Mm.
But I think over the years, you know, she never talked to me about it, just never. She would ask my brother-in-law, and sometimes she'd ask my wife, and she would never talk to me. And I just got the feeling that she knew this Australia story was sort of preposterous. And and now, in the past few months, she's been diagnosed with stage 4 cervical cancer, and they're not telling her. And she's going to die soon. And they're considering the possibility. She's too weak for chemo. Surgery is not possible. They're considering the possibility of radiation. They still won't tell her. And I'm just, I just stay out of it because I totally disagree with it. She can't now, you know, she couldn't mourn her son, and now she can't prepare herself to die, which is going to happen pretty soon.
Tom, thank you for sharing your story.
Thank you.
Listening to Tom and thinking about everything we've been talking about so far, at the end of your This American Life piece, you say you're not sure of the answer, but I wonder if you've made up your mind since then, making the movie, would you do this? Would you tell this lie to your own parents about a terminal diagnosis for them if it ever came up?
Well, I asked them that, and my mother said, I said, would you want me to lie to you guys? And she said, what, are you crazy? Of course not. But meanwhile, she felt that I should absolutely respect the decision of my Chinese family members. But then my mother said something interesting. She said, you know, it's also a moot point in America, because if one of us was diagnosed with illness, the doctor is legally obligated to tell us. And the question you should really be asking is that if your father or I got very ill, and we found out from the doctor this news, would we tell you?
We've got about a minute and a half left. Let me ask you something about the film. The dialogue is, or just, you know, the movie making of the film, it's for the most part in Mandarin. What hurdles did you have to go through to get this movie made the way you envisioned it?
Quite a lot, because in the beginning, as you can imagine, pitching a movie about my Chinese grandmother in China with an all-Asian, Asian-American cast, 75%, 80% in Mandarin with subtitles, but still an American film with an American perspective, not the easiest to pitch. And people kept wanting to know, is this an American film? Is it a Chinese film? And wanting to put it in a box. And it really took me saying no to those opportunities and doing This American Life. When the story aired on This American Life is when the right producers came to me.
Did Crazy Rich Asians being a hit helped you to get this produced?
It actually didn't, because we started making this film before Crazy Rich Asians came out. And so we did not have that as a precedent. And I'm quite certain that my producers, the reason they wanted to make the film is because they told me they heard it on the radio and sat in the car and cried.
Isn't that great? So thank you, Ira Glass.
Yes.
And thank you, Lulu Wong, director and writer of The Farewell. Thank you for joining us and talking to some of our listeners with their own stories.
Thank you.
The Brian Lehrer Show is produced today by Lisa Allison, Zoe Azoulay, Jeremy House, and Priscilla Allaby, with the head of live radio, Megan Ryan, Matt Morondo, and Leora Noam Kravitz. At the audio controls, I'm Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening to Brian Lehrer Weekend. We're back on the radio Monday morning at 10 a.m. In the meantime, follow us on Twitter at Brian Lehrer or facebook.com/Brian Lehrer WNYC, where there's always a conversation 24/7.